Welcome to In Your Brain. I'm a neuroscience student at the University of Florida, and I'm super curious about everything having to do with the brain. Join me to discover what happens
in your brain.
Anxiety disorders have many faces, and they can be complicated to study and to understand. It feels like the conversation around anxiety has been getting louder over the past few years, and especially after the pandemic. I'm curious to know the basic mechanisms and how having an anxiety disorder can change what happens in your brain. We have a very special guest that will guide us through today's episode.
My name is Carol Matthews, and I am a psychiatrist and the Brook Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Florida. I also am the director of the Center for OCD, Anxiety, and Related Disorders at UF.
As always, let's start with a definition. What are anxiety disorders?
Anxiety-related disorders are disorders where normal anxiety, which we all have, gets out of control. So everybody can relate to fear, right? And fear and anxiety are actually not the same thing, but they're both evolutionarily and developmentally adaptive and normal. And so an example of fear is an immediate threat response. If a tiger shows up in the room, you're afraid, you get your fear response on, and you get ready to get out of there. Anxiety is the same kind of a threat response, but it's not to a real immediate threat. It's to an anticipated threat or a possible threat. So a great example of that is everyone gets anxious before a job interview or before a date. And the purpose of that anxiety, which is perfectly normal, is to make you kind of be on your best A game. Your focus is sharp, your alertness is high, and you are paying attention. So that's normal anxiety. And as you get comfortable or you get into the job interview or the job interview ends, your anxiety recedes. And so there's a very predictable path of anxiety that's normal. So it's usually highest right before something happens, and it starts to kind of get better as you get into something, and then it goes away as the event ends. Anxiety disorders are disorders where there is something wrong with that normal distribution over time. So either the anxiety spikes so high that you can't manage it, like in a panic symptom, or it continues at a high rate such that it just never gets better, like generalized anxiety disorder, or it's an anxiety in response to something that most people don't get anxious in regard to. So we all get anxious for talks and job interviews, but talking to friends shouldn't make us anxious. And so somebody with social anxiety might feel very anxious talking to a classmate or somebody who's even a friend. And so basically anxiety is a normal experience, and it's a disorder when that normal experience becomes more severe, happens at the wrong time, or doesn't go away when it's supposed to.
It can be tricky to know if one has a normal amount of anxiety or an excessive amount that qualifies as a disorder. So let's hear Dr. Matthews' perspective on this.
Yeah, that's actually a great question. And I think exactly to your point, anxiety is such a common experience in everyday life that many people don't know that they have one. I'll give you a personal example. I have social anxiety disorder, and I didn't know that for most of my life. And I wasn't able to talk on the telephone to order a pizza because I was too afraid to talk to the person on the other end of the phone. And when I came home from college, I was very anxious about calling my high school friends because I hadn't seen them in a while. But I didn't know that that was social anxiety disorder until I went to medical school and residency and learned about what social anxiety disorder was. I thought I was shy. And I was shy, but this is beyond being shy, right? So a lot of people just live with anxiety and don't know it. But if you think about it, if it gets in the way of your daily functioning, it's probably a disorder. So the fact that I wouldn't call for a pizza or call my friends meant that I ran the risk of, you know, spending my summer all by myself rather than visiting with the people who I had been very close to over the years. This was in the days before cell phones and text, so I couldn't keep in touch with them easily during the school year. But so if it's impairing or if it causes a substantial amount of distress on an ongoing basis, then that's how we think about it being a disorder. If it is situational, normal, goes away, and is not excessive. So social anxiety disorder should not cause you to leave school because you can't handle sitting in a classroom, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to get anxiety, and it's normal anxiety if you're asked to give a talk. But if it's a requirement for your class, you should still be able to get through it and do that talk, because it would be impairing if you couldn't and you failed the class, for example. So it's the level of impairment and distress that's caused by the disorder. Now, there's some things like a panic attack. A panic attack is always pathological in the sense that a panic attack is not normal anxiety. That said, a panic attack does not mean you have a psychiatric disorder. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean you have an anxiety disorder. People can have excessive anxiety that can cause them impairment in, you know, in isolated instances in areas of extreme stress, right? And that doesn't mean that you have an anxiety disorder. So you have to kind of also be aware that you can have the symptoms of an anxiety disorder in extreme circumstances mm-hmm. without actually having a disorder.
What causes someone to develop an anxiety disorder?
Well, we're not really sure all of the causes of anxiety. We know that there's a strong genetic component to the anxiety disorder. So probably somewhere between 30 and 50% of anxiety disorders, well, all of the anxiety disorders have a genetic component. But the contribution to anxiety is about 30 to 50%, which means there's this very strong environmental component. We know also some of the environmental triggers, although not all of them. So we know that, for example, things like being bullying or being teased can actually precipitate a social anxiety, although they're not the only thing that precipitates social anxiety. We don't really know what causes phobia, so fear of grasshoppers or dogs, or sometimes it's an exposure to a threat, right? A real exposure to a dog may make you to develop a dog phobia, but many people have dog phobias without ever being threatened by a dog. So there's environmental factors that can contribute. What I would say is that the genetics are not really causative in the sense that they don't cause anxiety disorders. What they are is a risk to developing an anxiety disorder. And then other factors often will then be added on to contribute to causing the disorder. So you may be at higher genetic risk. You have an increased susceptibility to developing an anxiety disorder, but it isn't necessarily a given that you'll get one over the course of your life, even if you have an increased risk. The other thing that we know is that anxiety disorders are disorders of the fear circuitry in the brain. And so we are starting to learn a little bit more about how that circuitry operates. And we know that that circuitry is essentially hyperactive in people with anxiety disorders. What we don't know is if that is hyperactive throughout life or if that develops across time. And that's a very interesting question that's still as yet not known. Well, there is actually a really interesting study that came out of Hopkins a number of years ago that actually shows that children of parents with anxiety disorders, so the children themselves don't have anxiety, but the parents do, if you give them cognitive behavioral therapy aimed at managing what might be anxious situations, you can actually show over time that you can prevent the development of pathological anxiety. So if you take a group of kids with parents with anxiety and you give them cognitive behavioral therapy and you take a group of kids with the same level of existing anxiety and parents who have anxiety and you don't give them cognitive behavioral therapy, about 30% of the control group will develop significant anxiety over the next year, whereas essentially no one or very few in the treatment group will. So you can actually, if you know that someone is high risk, you can actually work to prevent, let's say, the development of an anxiety disorder, or at least lessen the severity of anxiety mm-hmm. symptoms. And so that does speak to there being some environmental interventions that we might be able to do early on.
To me, this study can be an example of the power of self-awareness and knowing our risk factors in order to, I guess, create tools that may help us avoid whatever risk may be in our genetic map. It turns out all psychiatric disorders have genetic factors, but none of them are deterministic, meaning there is no guarantee of developing the disorder. Apparently, our nurture can really balance out our nature. So how do the many types of anxiety disorders differ from each other?
All of the anxiety disorders have as a common feature what I've said, they have anxiety in an abnormal time, for an abnormal length of time, or as an abnormal level of anxiety, but they differ in terms of their patterns. So generalized anxiety disorder, which is probably the most common anxiety disorder, I actually like to describe to people as worry floating around looking for something to latch on to. So many people don't even know that they have generalized anxiety disorder who have it. They just are worriers. And so, you know, they're always finding, not consciously, but finding something to worry about. If it's not finances, it's friends. If it's not friends, it's family. If it's not family, it's school. And that level of anxiety is chronic. It waxes and wanes a little bit, but it tends to kind of stick around most of the time. And it can make you feel very physically uncomfortable. You can feel restless. You can have sleep troubles. You can have concentration troubles. You can have muscle tension and headaches. But it's really more chronic and kind of just people live with it in the background. A lot of people just live with it in the background. That's really different than panic disorder, where you have a trigger. Your anxiety goes from 0 to 100 within 5 minutes. But 30 minutes later, it's back down to maybe not 0, but 10. So a high peak of anxiety symptoms that make you feel like maybe you're going to die or go crazy. And then, you know, 30 minutes later, it's essentially gone. So the difference is 0 to 100, but short term, versus kind of living out of 50, but all the time. The interesting thing about the anxiety disorders is they don't have to be triggered. You can have a panic attack that wakes you up from sleep. Generalized anxiety disorders is kind of chronic low-level anxiety, or can be high-level, but looking for a target. Other things do have a trigger. So specific phobia, fear of grasshoppers or needles, those are clearly triggered. But they can be triggered by things such as seeing a picture of a grasshopper or seeing a picture of a needle. So they're not necessarily even triggered by real things. And then social anxiety is also more, it's situational, I think is what I would say, rather than triggered. Because you can also have social anxiety without being around people. You can then think about all the things you might have done wrong in this social situation, or worry about all the things that are going to happen in this social situation. And so there is a context in a situation, but it may not be specifically triggered.
We've heard about how the fear circuit can be overactive in people with anxiety disorders. Let's dive in a bit more into the details of this changed brain state.
There are a number of brain regions involved in anxiety disorders, and I think it's important to know that it's not one brain region that's involved in any of the psychiatric disorders. Psychiatric disorders are disorders of brain circuits rather than brain regions. And that makes it complicated because it's not easy to isolate what the problems are. But I think the way to think about it is that it is a hyperactive fear response, and the brain regions that are involved are those that are involved in fear responses. So the amygdala is the biggest one. Memory actually plays a role in anxiety too, to some degree, but the amygdala is really the region, one of the main regions that's involved, and the amygdala then connects to cortical regions or higher order functioning regions, and also to more primitive regions like the thalamic regions in ways that then kind of, if you might want to say it this way, trigger your primitive brain to be afraid and then tell your higher functioning brain to run away or to do whatever, you know, what the response is. And the idea there is that circuitry is responsible for fear extinction. So the idea that when the threat goes away, the fear also goes away. This is an oversimplified explanation in some ways, but in somebody who's anxious, that extinction circuit either is always kind of hyperactive or is hypersensitive and so reacts when maybe it shouldn't be reacting.
It is relatively easy to induce the fear response in animal models to study the fear circuit. However, inducing anxiety can be much harder. Dogs are an example of animals that clearly show anxiety behaviors. And I can confirm this with my dog every time it rains here in Florida, which is a lot. So how do researchers like Dr. Matthews study anxiety in humans?
In humans, we do neuroimaging. So we use MRI and functional MRI mostly to look at how the brain reacts when you put it under stress. And so one of the things you can do is you can put somebody in an imaging machine, a neuroimaging machine, an MRI, and give them a task that makes them anxious. Do something that generates social anxiety, for example, and look at what happens in healthy people who don't have an anxiety disorder and in people who do have anxiety disorders in their brain. We also know a little bit about the brain actually in anxiety disorders from studies of neuroendocrine systems, so cortisol and other neuroendocrine systems, which are also active in the brain, can give you some information about how the pathophysiology of the brain works. But really, most of what we know is either from animal studies or from neuroimaging studies. We've also done genetic studies that look at how these disorders track in families or regions of the genome that may differ between people with and without anxiety disorders to get a sense of the genetic underpinnings, although that work is a little farther behind because you need very large samples to get that.
Overthinking, being nervous, and fearful are things that I consider to be in my thoughts and not really tangible. But most of the time, these things can lead to actual physical changes in my body, like chills or sweat. What are the physical components of anxiety disorders?
So that's actually also a great question, and I would argue that not all anxiety is in your thoughts. Many people have physiologic symptoms of anxiety and no cognitive association. So they're anxious and they feel it in their bodies and they don't have any cognitions or thoughts or fears that go along with it. And that actually becomes more and more common the longer you have an anxiety disorder. You have the physiological symptoms of anxiety without any kind of concept of what the cognitive triggers might be. So one way to think about it is that the neurotransmitter systems that are involved in anxiety are serotonin and the norepinephrine system, which is the fight or flight system, right, which you could imagine would be dopamine to a lesser extent, and then GABA and glutamate. And serotonin, let's just take that as a simple example. You have serotonin receptors in your brain, but you also have them in your gut and in your skin. And if you've ever been really anxious, you will know that you probably get butterflies in your stomach, and you may also get other physical GI symptoms of anxiety. And so lots of people, when they're anxious, feel like they might have to vomit or have other kinds of GI symptoms. Some people will even break out in hives when they're anxious, right? Similarly, chronic anxiety, just like chronic stress, can cause inflammation, can cause headaches and migraines. Muscle tension is a really common symptom of anxiety. And in fact, it's included in the definition of generalized anxiety disorder. So there's lots of physiological symptoms. And chronic muscle tension can lead to actually fairly significant downstream long-term problems if it's not addressed. So just like every psychiatric illness, anxiety disorders have a pretty profound effect on the body. They also all affect sleep. And if you can't sleep, we know that poor sleep can contribute to chronic illness, even to increased blood sugar and insulin resistance in the longer term. So lots of physiological effects.
We're not meant to be in a constant fight or flight state. This connection between the mind and the body is important, though I don't really know what the mind is. Is it the brain or something else? We'll leave that for another episode. So, what are the treatment options for someone with an anxiety disorder?
So actually, for the anxiety disorders, there's lots of treatments available, which is lucky. So medications, we'll start with that because it's probably the easiest to understand, but there's many different choices. And so, as I mentioned, there are neurotransmitter systems that are involved in anxiety, and serotonin, the adrenergic system, norepinephrine and epinephrine, essentially, and the GABA and glutamate system are the three main ones that are involved. And so the main medications for anxiety disorders target those systems. So SSRIs, serotonin reuptake inhibitors like Prozac, fluoxetine, or Zoloft, sertraline, are very commonly used to treat anxiety disorders, and they're actually quite effective for many people. Treatments that target the norepinephrine system are also very effective, and that's often actually the older medications. So tricyclic medications like imipramine or amitriptyline can be used effectively, and some of the newer medications that target both serotonin and norepinephrine are commonly used, like venlafaxine or I've lost the other name for now, but at any rate, the SNRIs, serotonin norepinephrine. They block reuptake of the neurotransmitter. So the neurotransmitter is released into the synapse to do its thing, and then it's basically recycled back into the cell. And what these medications do, at least most of them, it's not mimic serotonin. They're not serotonin themselves. What they do is they block the reuptake of serotonin or norepinephrine. So they allow it to be out in the synapse doing its thing and binding to receptors longer. And interestingly enough, whereas an antibiotic can take effect in a few days, most treatments for psychiatric disorders, and this is certainly true for the anxiety disorders, take 4 to 6 to 12 weeks. And so it's not even the immediate effect, the hanging around of serotonin or norepinephrine that is the effect. It's something longer term downstream. So it's doing something in the brain that's a kind of a cascade chain. And we're not entirely sure, although there's some hypotheses, we're not entirely sure what that is. So it's not mimicking the neurotransmitters specifically, and it's not that there's too much or too little of one of them. The exception to that, I think, is the GABA system. And so benzodiazepines are another treatment for anxiety disorders. And they're not, generally speaking, a long-term treatment, but they work in the minute. So if you have a really bad panic attack, such that, you know, your heart rate goes up dangerously high, you may get from a doctor a benzodiazepine, which will bring your anxiety down in the short term. Some symptoms of anxiety tend to get worse again, even if you're on those medications, in the long term, and some other symptoms will continue to be improved. So they don't work in the long term for most people, and they're not recommended in the long term for most people. But for most of the ones that are actually the most effective and in the longer term are the ones we keep people on, it's not a direct one-to-one relationship. It's a more complicated issue, right? And so we're now exploring new treatments that actually directly modulate the circuit. So transcranial magnetic stimulation, which is magnetic stimulation to the, not to the deep parts of the brain, but to the outside of the brain. It's non-invasive. It's not painful. That's been approved for depression, and that is now being explored for generalized anxiety, for example.
Awesome.
More effective for most forms of anxiety, or for many forms of anxiety, are therapies. So cognitive behavioral therapy, exposure response prevention therapy, can actually teach your brain not to overreact to situations or to triggers. And so social anxiety disorder is particularly a good one for that kind of a therapy. Panic disorder, if you have a cognitive component to it, can be very effective for that. Some forms of anxiety are a little bit harder to treat with those forms of therapy, but they can also be effectively treated. And then things like mindfulness and body-focused therapies can also be very effective, usually in combination, but some people can respond very well to just one form of treatment versus another. And then the plants, you mentioned the plants, and that's actually very interesting. So I study with some colleagues here kava, which is an herb that's used in Indonesia for relaxation. And we're quite interested in looking at that as a kind of a milder form of treatment for anxiety disorders and maybe for sleep problems. And we think that kava is actually, we think we know what the chemicals that are active in the anxiety treatment are in kava. We think we've isolated the chemicals. And we also think that it's using a different mechanism. It may not actually be serotonin or GABA in the way that some of these others are. It may actually have a different mechanism of action in the brain. That's a study that's still going on, so I can't answer whether it's real or not. But it is an interesting potential new treatment.
That's exciting. Yeah.
Anxiety treatments can look different for everyone. It's personal and conditional, not a one-size-fits-all.
Interestingly, for me, the most effective treatment was ballroom dancing. Right? So when I was in medical school, my entire class lived in a dorm, and we spent 8 hours a day together in our preclinical classes. And so we got to know each other pretty well, but I was still pretty shy and had social anxiety, as I didn't know at the time. And they taught free ballroom dancing classes in the recreation center. And ballroom dancing is interesting because it's a little bit like you would do cognitive behavioral therapy for social anxiety. It's about 3 minutes long. You know, it's the length of a dance. And there's kind of a script. You introduce yourself to someone. You ask, may I have this dance? Or you say yes to this dance. You don't talk a whole lot during that 3 minutes, but there's a little bit of conversation, and then you're done and you move on to the next person. So it is kind of an exposure, a social exposure, and it's a repeated exposure where you do it every 3 minutes. And it's very effective because it basically teaches your brain that this is not something that you have to be afraid of. And so that's one of the ways I actually started to learn that anxiety could be treated with kind of repeated exposures before I knew anything about what CBT was or cognitive behavioral therapy was and how it worked. So I also think it's important to talk about anxiety disorders. People don't, they're not afraid to say that they have asthma, but they are afraid to say that they have an anxiety disorder or another psychiatric illness. And so breaking down those barriers is really important.
It's cool to think about how we can change our thought patterns and our experiences in certain situations. You can teach your brain to respond in different ways, but this can be really hard work. It seems like anxiety disorders and rates of mental health in general are increasing, or maybe it's just talked about more now. I want to know what Dr. Matthews thinks about this and how we may be able to help the situation.
Yeah, so over our lifetime, about 30% of people will have an anxiety disorder. We'll meet criteria for a psychiatric anxiety disorder, psychiatrically defined anxiety disorder. And I think that rates of acute anxiety are absolutely increasing. I'm not sure that rates of anxiety disorders are increasing, but as you remember, I talked about people can be at risk and never develop an anxiety disorder. And then when there's a stressor or an extreme event, that can actually push you over the edge. And some of those people maybe push over the edge and stay with an anxiety disorder. And some of those people maybe push over the edge and develop a kind of a transient anxiety disorder and then come back to their baseline resilience. And so I think being aware of the fact that this is a very stressful time in our world right now, and there are many, many triggers out there and increased stresses in lots of different ways and shapes and forms is one thing. Just knowing that stress is high, and if you might be somebody who's at increased risk, to take care of yourself. And I'm a big fan of, I would say, I'm not going to say prophylactic therapy exactly, but doing the kind of ballroom dance version of exposure response prevention, which is getting out in the world and helping treat in small ways your anxiety before it becomes uncontrollable is another way. And I think the last way is if you really feel like you can't manage it, to seek help, right? It's really important to seek help. Mm-hmm. And the last thing that's really important is it's almost always the case that anxiety has less power if it's outside your head than inside your head. So if you verbalize it and you can talk about it, it's much less powerful than if it stays in your head and you spin about it. So just getting it out and talking about it can be a step in the right direction to help manage it.
I hope you enjoyed this episode and learned something new. Follow In Your Brain on Twitter and let me know what topic or guest you'd like to hear on the podcast. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.